I appreciate you jumping on, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it looks like you got an impressive wall back there behind you.
Oh yeah, I do. It's a bad habit, you know. It looks like you got some back there too.
I got a couple. I've only ever mounted, I've got four deer that I mounted. That's the only thing I've ever mounted. Never mounted any elk or antelope or anything like that. You start mounting elk, it gets expensive and then you run out of room pretty quick.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Geez. Yeah. Even a deer, I think, is like $1,000, you know? So
yeah. I've got this buck right here that I've got. I don't know if you could see it maybe, but it,
oh yeah. Yeah.
So I had that buck mounted and, it's actually kind of a fun story, but a guy that mounted, his name's Russ Bulkley, and he owned a taxidermy shop in a small town called Panguitch here where I live, but he mounted my dad's bull, which it's the only animal that my dad ever killed that he had mounted, but it was basically a big five. He's basically a mainframe five, but he's like 330, but he killed that like 1986, I think, which was a huge deal back then, but he had it mounted, but that bull hung over our piano, which I have the piano that was my childhood home. But yeah, he mounted that bull, but I took that buck to him when I killed it. And he's like, yeah, man, I'd love to mount that up for me. He did that for me. I think he charged me like $500, might even been less.
No way. Wow. Yeah. That's a great deal, man.
Yeah.
It's a great buck too.
Yeah, pretty cool. So thanks for jumping on. For people that are listening, I have Matt Tillotson. Did I say your name right?
Yeah. Yep. The O sounds like an I. So yeah. Yep. Gotcha. Tillotson.
There you go. So I came across your YouTube channel the other day. So it was like an evening and I was just had some downtime and I was just cruising YouTube and looking, and I saw one of your hunt films pop up, which was a mule deer hunt. Was that from this year?
Yeah, I have quite a few, but I'm guessing it probably was. It is probably my dad and I on the front photo there, maybe. So
yeah, it's big velvet buck. Yeah,
big velvet buck. Yep, that was this year. Yep. So
yeah, so I watched that film and I thought, man, it was a really cool, it was a cool film, cool experience. Obviously, you know, a giant buck helps. But then I went down a rabbit hole of just kind of chasing and looking at a bunch of your other films. And so I hit you up because I was curious as to, just get to meet you, get to know you a little bit better and kind of, you know, pick your brain a little bit. And hopefully, you know, you can help some of the listeners of my podcast understand how it is that you're doing what you do. So I appreciate you jumping on.
Yeah, man. I hope you enjoyed them. They're pretty raw and real. You know, they're not Hollywoodized too much, and the audio is off. There's a lot of things, but it's about as best I can doing it solo up on the mountain, you know.
But, man, I have to commend you. So I watched another one of your mule deer hunts that you did. It was an archery hunt, and I think you were kind of hunting like some edge of a field, maybe. It looked like there was some of the field that had been cut or, you know, tilled up. Yeah. And you shot this buck. He was kind of down in a ravine and you'd snuck in close to him. And I had to commend the dedication to filming, man, because you set up it looked like a digiscope set up on this buck and you're doing this all solo. Plus you had film, you know, of the buck that you were filming plus the shot. I was like, man, this guy's all in on filming. So that was really, it was cool from a viewer's perspective. It was awesome.
Yeah, I love that video for that reason. I've tried over the years, like I've had a lot of comments on my videos that like, hey, no kill shot, you know, it was fun, it was awesome to watch, but no kill shot. And I guess I have the mentality that like if it's a big deer or a big bull or something, I'm not gonna like sacrifice harvesting the animal for getting a kill shot. And you know, it makes the video less exciting, but on that specific one, it was really cool because he had no idea I was there. It was, the wind was good. I had lots of time and I was able to set up that GoPro. And then, like you said, the digiscope on the buck. And when he stood up, and it was one of my best shots I've ever made. You know, it was one of the guys was like a 12 ringer. I don't know. You know, he's like, that was a good shot, man. So I was pretty proud of it. And, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Yeah. That's way cool.
Where are you from?
So I'm originally from Central Idaho. Yeah, I grew up when, geez, I mean, it was kind of the transition between the deer being really good and then the elk kind of coming in, and wolves were introduced there. And so just, I don't know. I mean, I grew up hunting. My dad took me hunting when I was a little kid. We hunted the Montana-Idaho border, and it just was instilled in me this love and passion for hunting, and it's something that once I tapped into it, during high school years and that era, I didn't hunt as much, but I killed a really good buck when I was 16, and I took him with my dad's rifle. He made a huge effort to take me out, and it ended up being like a 195 buck. Actually, it's this, you can kind of see that's that buck right there, actually. And that velvet buck. And it something kind of switched in me. It just I found a love and a passion for it, and it just spread like a wildfire. I couldn't get enough of it. And to this day, I can't wait for my next hunt. I can't wait for next year. And it's so exciting to me,
Yeah, what is it? What is it? What I
I
mean,
that's
like what gets you going? Can you put like a thumb on it? Because I can't exactly either. I don't maybe I if I tried, maybe I could, but
Yeah.
it's like the adventure and then just kind of like the unknown of like how it's all going to come together. You try to visualize it and you try to picture it like how it would ultimately work, and you've got a game plan and maybe you've done some scouting and stuff, but for me it's like this the unknown. It's the adventure of it, right? Like what's
Yeah.
over that next ridge? What am I going to glass up? How's it going to work? Am I going to be able to like keep it together in the moment, and like actually execute a shot? And then I think the ultimate thing and I'll let you talk here in a sec, but the thing I'm like most addicted to is the feeling of satisfaction that I feel when it works out on an
Oh,
animal that I
yes.
like I've really worked hard for. It's like the ultimate thrill of like this just overwhelming feeling of satisfaction. Like, man, I really did something that was really hard.
Yeah. I agree with you, Trail, that I think for me, it's doing something it's unheard of. Like this, we're, like being the 10% that can harvest bucks with a bow, or, guys that can kill bulls with bows or muzzleloaders or whatever. Even harvesting an animal itself is very, very difficult. And so I think my passion for the sport of, I guess it's not my passion for the lifestyle of hunting is, I just like feed off of those moments, I guess. And then the other thing is I've screwed up the shot enough. I've screwed up that last moment that, like you're saying, I it's an addiction to get to that point. Like it's so difficult to get there. But then I want to prove to myself once again that like I can keep it together, I can be patient, I can let that buck stand, I can play the wind. And it's just kind of proving to myself every single year that that I can accomplish it, So maybe I think that's I don't really know how to explain it. Like it's just it's a burning desire to continue the journey, just like you're saying, So
Do you so the did when you start when did you start bow hunting?
That's been maybe the last 15 years. I'm 37, so I've been hunting, like pretty hard since I've been 16, since I was 16. So I rifle hunted for that first, 10 years or whatever. And then I took my wife out and we found this buck in a field, and he was kind of like coming in and out on the public and private, and we ended up killing it. It wasn't pretty, it was a beginner's experience, and there was some arrows over his back, and a lot of, there was some interesting things that happened. But I guess that's where it all started, is like just being able to sneak in close. You don't get that anywhere else, you know, like you don't get that really with a rifle. They being able to hear their hoof prints, being able to hear them breathing, you know, watching their antlers, just reading all of those senses. You don't get that usually with a rifle. So that's kind of when I transitioned. And then I've been off and on between rifle and bow. I haven't gone full bow yet, but the last year I've killed four deer, four really good deer with a bow. And I'm kind of leaning that direction. So we'll see what next year brings, I guess.
No, I'm not full bow either. I mean, I love to bow hunt. Don't get me wrong. I absolutely love it. I love to shoot. I was out shooting this morning. You know, just after you texted me, but I was out just getting some arrows in this morning. I love to bow hunt, but I'm like opportunistic, right? So if I can get a rifle tag and it's the right time of year and I don't have anything else going on, I don't have anything against rifle hunting for sure. So that first buck that you killed with a bow, you said did you miss your first shot?
Yes, I did. Like it, and I'll tell you, it was a so I took my dad's bow from his case. Like, we came home from college, and it was like a Friday night, and I had seen that buck, and I was like, I'm gonna go try and shoot it. And it was end of September, so you know, not rifle season yet. But I said, Dad, you got a bow out there? And so I went and got his bow tech out and shot it at a paper plate a couple times, which I probably shouldn't admit this, but and then I thought, yeah, I'm a bow hunter now, right? You know, I could just walk out there, and I learned real quickly that practice is important. And even just like I didn't have my anchor point yet. I never, you know, my draw link was probably off. There was a lot of things with that bow that weren't set to me, obviously. And I definitely missed. But I think that kind of like spurred on the passion for it, you know, because it's like, wow, you know, I failed, you know, and I failed hard. So like, I don't want to feel that again. I want to get better. And we ended up taking that buck. It took a few arrows, you know, but we got it done. So,
You sound exactly like me. That's exactly what I did. I dug my dad's old Fred Bear bow out of the case. I had mismatched broadheads, you know, the sight with brass pins, you know, makeshift release. Like I don't even remember draw length. It probably wasn't even close, but I did the same thing and went out and, you know, I bought a spike elk tag because that's what we could hunt here in Utah. And I missed my first animal I ever shot at with a bow, which is a spike that my dad called in, and I shot right underneath him. And I've told this story many times, but it's pretty incredible to me the number of people that I talk to, a lot of really super accomplished bow hunters and hunters in general that have whiffed that first shot, you know, and they start from a similar place, right? Like that they had this like growing curiosity in their head that were like, oh, maybe I would like to try bow hunting, you know, and I've got access to a bow. Maybe it's my dad's bow or a friend's bow or something like that. And they borrow it and they take some practice shots, just like you're saying, and they go out and it sparks this. And like, as you're describing it, it hits home for me because that's exactly what happened to me. You know, I fell in love with that whole entire process of our archery, you know, I got a bow the next year and started practicing and started working at it. And it's just like I think probably most people start like that. It's just incredible of how many people I talked to that have like had that spark and whiff that first shot.
And I, you know, I think it's important that I mean, go try it. You know, for anybody listening, I guess, that wants to get into bow hunting, you should go try it. You know, and you don't have to know everything. You don't have to be an expert, but I think the passion that like you'll find real quick that it's very exciting. And that just I don't know. I think that it was good that I missed, because if I would hit it, probably would have been like, oh, this is cake, you know, this is a piece of cake, right? But no, it turns out it's way more difficult than I thought, you know. So
I agree. And it's good advice, sound advice. you know, hunting in general. I talked to a lot of people. My brother, my older brother, he's a kind of what we call an adult onset hunter. And there's so much to learn. And, you know, a mentor is great if you can get a mentor to go into it. But I think that's sound advice, is just like, go for it. Just do it. It's the same advice I give people that are coming from the Midwest or the East Coast and they want to come out and hunt the West. You can read all the articles and you can watch all the YouTube videos and, you know, you can reach out to people like yourself and, you know, you can offer advice. But reality is you don't figure it out until you do it. You got to do it, and you got to be like vulnerable enough and like being okay with like failure. Because even now it still happens to me. Like I still fail. I still make mistakes, but you got to make them over and over again to then like eventually kind of start to figure it out at a level that you start to harvest some animals. So I think it's awesome advice of like, just jump in both feet and just go for it. Get a bow and go for it.
Yeah. Get a bow. Yeah. Yeah. I think the hardest part about bow hunting too, is that like every scenario is different. And until you go through those, like you won't be able to know how you will react. You know, like I haven't had one experience throughout my life, like one stock that's exactly identical to another one. Right. Mm-hmm. And I haven't had the wind always in the same direction, or just all those variables that you have. You know, maybe you'll have an extra buck that's above the big buck that you have to deal with. Right. Or, and so you can't, it take a lifetime worth of explaining, I feel, for a beginner to understand those scenarios. So yeah, just get out there and do it. You know, if you mess up, go for it again, right? Don't give up. I think just keep going. And the first success you'll have is when you get within range, you know, because you'll finally realize like, wow, I did that. I accomplished all of those steps all the way to that point. And then the next part is the hardest part, right? Which is execution of shot, draw, like draw, shot, pin placement, all of those things. And so that's like a whole nother level, I would say. But yeah, definitely, I would just say get out. You know, get out and enjoy it. It sure is a lot of fun, you know.
Sure. Have you have you ever had a situation, and I'm guilty of this, the reason it pops to my head as I'm thinking about it and talking to you. Have you ever had a situation that you fell in love with an animal? You wanted it so bad that you were too timid to even make an approach on it?
Yes. Oh, yes. I was. I ended up killing it's the one in the middle there. It took me 16 days to figure him out. And it was... He's a big, big buck. He's a 211 deer, but, so he's big deer, you know, and I just felt like, for one, I wasn't able to find him in a good spot. And then I didn't want to screw it up once I did find him. And, I think patience is important, especially on an animal that you want really bad, but also you got to be aggressive, and you can't sit back on a glassing knob and wait till the perfect moment, because it will never come around, you know. I think you just have to like look at your variables and look at how much of an advantage you will have over that animal. And if your advantage is, you know, 60 to 70% more than that animal, you need to go for it, I would say, because you're never going to get to 100% advantage, or even 90 or 80, right?
Yeah.
So I would just say, be aggressive, but if it's an animal you really want, be smart about it. I just go for it, you know?
Yeah. It's a fine line, right? And it's, you're watching it. I've had animals that I really wanted, particularly mule deer. I don't know why mule deer seem to have, and I think they do over a lot of people. They kind of hold this reverence, right? Expect a big mule deer. I have so much respect for a big mule deer, just in their senses, their ability to always get away, it feels like. So at the last moment, you know, they hear you, they smell you, they see you. It just seems like they're so switched on, and they're such a big, smart animal. So I have this, this reverence for him, in that I've at times talked myself out of like situations where I thought, you know what, there's a chance I could get in there and I could get in position, but it probably won't happen. They're too big. They're too smart. I'm just going to like sit on my hands and I'm going to wait for the perfect opportunity. So it's like this fine line of being aggressive and going, and then, you know, being patient, which I think is probably one of the biggest battles I have personally, on knowing like when to make a stock and then, you know, and then just not making it all. Right. So I think it's interesting. Are there factors to you that are, kind of you look at and you think, yeah, that factor tips the scale in my favor?
Yeah. So if it's a stockable position, so if we're talking like mountains, or I don't hunt the low country a ton. That video that you saw where I shot that buck, it was kind of, I guess I don't normally hunt that way, but I guess the number one thing for me would be if the deer places itself in a stockable position. And that being said, it could be, you know, within range of the top of a knob or a draw or a cliff edge or something like that, that I am able to get to, then definitely it's a go, I would say, even if the wind is not always great, because as you know, the wind can change really quick. And then the other thing that I guess I found a little bit of a secret, I would say, is that if I'm able to travel country quickly, which is, you know, deals with like, if I'm in good shape, I guess, and I know how to navigate terrain, I can get to them in their first bed. And that's a really crucial variable for me. If I can get to them at their first bed and I have a really good stockable position, or they're in a good spot, then the wind I can deal with, right? I can move around with the wind. But I know if I can get them in their first bed, I don't have to wait there all day. I won't have to wait for 3 to 4 hours. And then the wind variable during that 3 to 4 hours just exponentially increases, right? Gotcha. So if I can get there by 9 or 9:30, that deer's gonna move at 10. Right? 10 to 10, 15, 10:30. And so I'll have a very short window that I have to manage those other variables. Mm-hmm. And then usually I'm also not exhausted from sitting there all day in the hot sun. So when the deer does stand, I can execute more efficiently and I can be more focused. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but like, I guess I would say, first bed in a stockable position. And those are my go-to things, you know?
Yeah. Answers it perfectly. It's interesting. Different people do it different ways. So like, I agree with you exactly what you're saying. I haven't had personally the best success in the fact that like, usually I'm hunting solo and it feels like by the time that I get there, maybe the deer has moved. So I often wait for second bed and, yeah. but I am waiting. You're right. In a lot of cases, like I'm waiting an hour and a half, 2 hours, 3 hours, you know, like mid afternoon, waiting for that buck to stand and make a move. And I've definitely, you know, screwed up either wind or, you know, getting into my own head, right? All that time I've got to just sit on it.
Yeah.
And I'm baking.
Is he really there still? Is yeah.
Yeah, exactly. As I'm talking, I'm thinking of a buck that I missed. So he was out in the sagebrush and he was kind of tucked in underneath this great big sagebrush. And, you know, he was shaded out, but the position I was able to get into, like I was right out in the open sun and I was there for probably, you know, 2.5-3 hours waiting for this buck to stand up. And I was just absolutely baking. It was probably in the 90s. And I got to the point where I was like, I'm just going to throw a rock over him. You know, the old trick, right? Yep. I'm going to distract him and throw a rock over him. And decided I just couldn't take the heat anymore. Threw it over the top of him. And, you know, he didn't stand up and look around. Like, he just bailed, right? He was gone. I've never had success with the old rock trick or, you know, trying to make some sort of distraction to get a buck to stand up to then execute a shot. But Yeah, I mean, that was just a complete mental, you know, breakdown due to the conditions of sitting there all day. So I think it's good advice. I love picking people's brains and hearing how different people do things, you know?
Yeah, it is dangerous though. And I would say you do run the risk, like you're talking about, of getting there and they're not even there. And so that's where I think you have to analyze it and make sure that you can get there before they're going to move. And you can watch the sun and kind of, you know, you'll get an idea of at what point is that sun going to hit them. And as soon as that sun hits that velvet, they're going to probably move, right?
Yeah.
Most likely. So, gotcha. But yeah.
So this progression of bow hunting for you and getting in tight and hunting in general, you know, you've gotten better at it. Obviously you're getting more consistent year over year. I think you would say, you know, you go from that point of missing that first buck and kind of the rodeo, it sounds like, that ensued, to the point now where, you know, you feels like you're making more consistent, better shots. What is it that you think you've learned? Like what transition has happened for you? Are you better able to calm your nerves? Is it equipment? Is it practice? Like any tips and tricks on actually being able to like be more confident in executing the shot when the moment hit happens?
Yeah, I think being patient is one of the biggest things for me. I try and, I have a personality of being aggressive, but then when it's time for the shot, I try and slow way, way down. And I think that's probably my biggest one there. The second one is just being familiar with your weapon and just animal intuition in general. Like you kind of, once you understand how mule deer work or elk or whatever, then you get more comfortable being within range of them because you kind of can read their ears. You can read their antler tips. You can, their body language, you know, when they're stressed, you know, when they've heard you or those kind of things. And so I think that's, my confidence comes from experience, I would guess, I would say, but also just learning how to be patient. And realizing that like you're out there to harvest that animal. It doesn't matter if it takes an hour or, you know, 15 minutes, a couple hours. If you go home, you're just going to have to hike your butt clear to the top of the mountain again and do it all over again. You might as well execute it properly the first time. And then you've accomplished your goal, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a good tip, and maybe this is kind of an underlying of what you're saying, but just the mystique of mule deer or elk, if that's you know your thing, of being within range, getting comfortable with that, and having done it enough times that you know you have the experience, but you're a little bit more comfortable, you're more at ease. I don't think that I'm at that point yet. You know, I've killed some bucks. I still get super excited. You know, I still get within range. It's usually like that 60 yard mark. I get within 60 yards and, you know, if I get closer, great. But once I get that mental reminder, hey, that buck's in range, that's when the nerves, you know, my mind starts going and my fingers start jittering and my legs start shaking. You know, I think you're right. I think it just takes reps of being within that, you know, danger zone, being comfortable with it. And then being able, like you said, to have the experience to be able to read the behavior of like, what does, you know, an antler tip mean? Or, you know, he's moving his head, which direction, what does that mean? You know, and you just have the experience of knowing when an animal is getting, you know, nervous or feels pressured or feels your presence. And again, you don't get that without experience, right?
Right. And I think I still feel the excitement, you know, like you're talking about. I definitely feel it. And it's something that I have to push down, because if I let it get too emotional, I'm not able to execute very well. Just because, you know, it's almost like a train wreck at that point, right? Yeah. Like whatever happens, happens. And I need to stay calm so that I can analyze what is happening and what I need to do, right? Because, you know, as soon as I hear that or see those ears come up or whatever, I need to be ready to draw because I know, wow, he smelled me, you know, like he knows, or if those antler tips start moving around, I need to be able to analyze that, you know.
How do you do that? How do you manage your emotion in those moments?
Well, I think it goes back to the same thing we kind of talked about a little while ago is like, I don't want to do that again. You know, I think the effort that I usually, these bucks are miles in the backcountry. You know, I've had to pack water in there. I found a buck, a target buck early in the season, and there's hours and hours and weeks of preparation up to that point. And so I think in my mind, it's just like anything, you know, like if it's a fourth quarter in a game or something like that, you just have that mindset that like, hey, it's over almost. And if I screw it up, I'm going to have to come back next Friday and try this all over again. Right. Or, and so maybe that's what calms me down. The other thing is, I think we just, with experience, you just get comfortable with being there. And as you harvest deer or as you harvest bulls or whatever it may be, you kind of like bank on that knowledge of the past experiences. And so you say like, hey, I've experienced this before. This scenario is similar, not the same, but I'm able to like, I guess, go back to those and, you know, take away from that, I guess.
Are you a self-talk person like in those moments?
Oh yes. Yeah.
Yeah, you are. Okay.
Yeah, I definitely do. Cause I'm solo. I don't have anybody to like usually bounce ideas off of. I was with my dad. He wasn't on the stock on that video, but I definitely talk to myself. And, I think my biggest, the thing I definitely express to myself is don't screw it up. Like, this is your chance. This is your one shot, right? Like, like you're going to really be ticked off when you get back and you made a dumb decision, to rush the shot, or you got way too close, right? I stalked to failure, or like, hey, you know, all those things, I'm just going to regret it if I don't execute properly. So don't do dumb stuff, Matt. You know, that's kind of what I say to myself, I guess.
Yeah. What distance do you like? So if you can, I mean, let's say that you've got a real stockable situation, you know, you could get to 25 or 30, know, based on the wind, and, you know, maybe cover, do you push that limit? Like what's your favorite distance as far as, you know, shooting a big buck?
I'd say 30 to 50 is the ideal because for one, the bows are fast enough now that you can get in a situation between 30 and 50 to where even if it does hear you or string jumps the bow, that arrow is most likely going to get there before that deer can react. So I don't like, I don't even shoot past 60 at all, for that exact reason. And it's not that I can't send them that far. It's that variable of string jumping, I want to eliminate that. Now it doesn't always happen. They can string jump you at 15 yards, right? Mm-hmm. But I've noticed that because the bows are quick enough, if you calculate your speed and the amount of time for that sound to get there, I'd say 30 to 50 is pretty a pretty good distance. And then, you know, at that distance, your bow is it's pretty forgiving. Even if you do torque it a little bit or whatever, even if, you know, your peep's not exactly centered on your housing or something, it's fairly forgiving. So that's what I would say is 30 to 50.
Yeah.
I don't like getting closer than that. Like if you're under 30, it's going to be something bad's going to happen. You know, like I've done it. I've killed a buck at 6 yards before, but it was not, it was because he was coming to me and I ambushed him and I didn't have a shot until he was literally right on top of me. And it was so yeah, I don't like doing that. I you know, 40 to 50 is my ideal range. That's when I stop stalking.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'd agree. It does, I don't know if there's any science behind it or not, but it does feel like they have a sixth sense, right? When you get within, especially if you're stalking that animal.
Oh yeah.
You know, I've had situations just like you're saying. I'm thinking of a situation. I was sitting in a little timber patch and kind of waiting to make a stalk on a different buck, and then I had this group of bucks feed in, and they ended up bedding, you know, like you're saying, 6 yards from me, right? And I remember just sitting there, like looking at these two bucks, and they were decent bucks, but they weren't the buck that I wanted to go after. Which consequently, like I couldn't make the stalk because then I had these two other bucks that were bedded 6 yards from me, right? I was just basically pinned down. But I remember thinking, this feels impossible to be this in close, you know, this close to this buck. And I don't think if they'd have walked in, you know, if they hadn't walked into me, I don't think that would have ever happened, that I could have actually made that stalk to them at 6 yards. You know, they just seem to be incredibly switched on, almost like a sixth sense, if you will. And I don't know if there's any science to it or not. Maybe it's just in their genes of been, you know, been hunting by mountain lions for years and years and years, that they just, it feels like you get within that 30-yard range, it's like they've got some sort of magnet to you. They just know you're
Yeah, dude,
there.
that totally. And I think if you, I mean, they got ears as big as elephants, you know, it feels like. So like just if you I played back a stock before. I've done this intentionally, as I would GoPro a stock just for the audio, because your GoPro will pick up a similar decibel, I would say, to I don't know. I don't know exactly what a mule deer is hearing. But if you record your stock, you'll find out how noisy you really are. And especially if you're within 20 yards, I think they just hear you. You know, they'll hear every stick, every grass, you know, crunch. And then you got the wind on top of that. Like at that point, your scent ball, I would say, I call it a scent ball, right, is so big that all it would take is just a slight, you know, whip around a tree or a tree edge, maybe a tree patch or a cliff, and it's going to send that scent right down to them. You know, even if the wind is, the directionals are headed a good direction, all it takes is one little, I don't know what you'd call it, but I just don't like getting that close. You know, it doesn't normally work out. So.
That's a hot take. You know, putting a GoPro on you and making a stock just to
Oh yeah.
evaluate. Yeah, I've never
Yeah.
thought about that. That's
Yeah.
interesting.
I
Yeah,
think
that's
if you
a good idea.
should do it, just do it, you know, on the off season or something. Just try and sneak in on, I don't know, a doe or whatever, and see how quiet it is, and play it back, because it's eye-opening how noisy I think we are. And we think we're all quiet, right? But no. So
I don't, but I, yeah.
yeah.
Do you have any tips and tricks for staying quiet?
You know, I've tried the stockasins and they're great. And I've tried socks. My new thing is the Salomon shoes. It's kind of a new, well, my wife and I did a marathon, or I guess it's a half marathon this summer, and I'd never done that before. And so we bought these shoes, and I started using them all the time. And what I found, especially on those, is like I can hike in them. They've got really good soles, but I can also feel the ground really well. And I think I'm not one to really drop my boots and stock in socks, because I never know when the stock's going to end. I mean, I could bump them just over the ridge or something, then I might have to keep going. And so I think you're most quiet in socks, but you run the risk of having to go clear back up to your boots on, you know, on the top of the mountain. So, yeah,
Are
I
you
don't
talking
know.
the Salomon five fingers? Are you talking like the toe shoes? Or are you talking just like a soft
No,
pair of
no, no.
Salomon running shoes?
Yeah, so like they're called the Speedcross Sixes is what they are, and I've got the Gore-Tex ones, and I like the Gore-Tex because, you know, the dew in the morning and all that, they do really well, but they flex, and then the sole is really quiet. I mean, it's got aggressive tread, but just really, really quiet. And that's my favorite pair of stocking shoes I've ever had.
Gotcha.
And you know, the other things are great. I love the Stockasins. Those guys are make a great product, and you can't beat socks. But
One of the interesting things about socks, I agree, it's almost like a trade-off, right? So you've got a sock, which is obviously going to be, quiet. You can feel the ground. One of the things that I've found, and I go back and forth on it, is that it feels like in a sock, I'm fighting for my balance so much. I almost wonder if it hinders me, because you don't have you don't have the grip, right? You don't have the ability to like maybe dig into a hillside like you might be able to if you've got like a soft-soled shoe. So it almost feels like I'm constantly fighting, and you're not really used to walking around barefoot in the woods anyway, right? So it's like I feel like I'm constantly fighting for my balance.
And I agree. And also shooting your bow with socks, there's a little bit of a variable there, because if it's like on a 45 degree angle or something, you just don't have the same stability as, you know, if you got a big thick wool sock, there's movement in that. So you just have to take it into account. Like you know, nothing's going to be perfectly quiet. And I just figure the ability to move and having a rigid sole to be able to be more stable is more important for me, I would say. But yeah.
You're just trying
Do you?
trying to tip the scales in your favor, which makes sense, again, on your style. As you were talking about the shoe, it's interesting. So I was up shooting my bow this morning, and I would encourage people to do this, but like next time you're at your range, just take a good size rock and stick that thing right in the middle of your foot, right? Like you're standing on it, and try to execute a shot. It's a way harder than just flat ground, right? And
It's so, yeah.
it's a lot harder. So yeah, definitely those little tiny variables, things like that, just a stone in your foot and the way you're feeling it, and maybe kind of tipping your ankle off kilter, it can definitely have an impact on your anchor and then executing a shot. So I hear you. That's interesting.
Yeah, for
yeah
sure.
um
No.
talk talk to me about your equipment. What are you shooting for, a bow and broadheads and arrows?
Yes, so I have an older bow. I have a Matthews. It's a V3, actually. And the reason why I stayed with the V3 was they made a 27. And so I shoot a smaller axis bow for a specific reason, because I'd say 90% of my shots are from my knees. When I'm in close to a deer, or, you know, whatever. So I've had a bad experience with a big riser bow, and I drew back on a bull. And when I wasn't even trying to kill the bull. The bull was just coming up the ridge, and I was kind of like trying to, I was like, okay, I'm gonna practice here. So I drew it back, and my limb just, it was really frigid cold that morning. My limb hit a rock, and the whole bow. And obviously the bow wasn't in good shape, but the bow actually just blew up right there. And I don't know what it was. Maybe it had been dry fired before I got it or something like that. But at that moment, I was like, I'm just gonna get a short bow. If I'm shooting between 30 and 50, I feel like I can execute well enough that I don't necessarily need the extra length. And so yeah, so that's what I shoot is I shoot a 27 V3, which is like a 3 or 4 year old bow. And they made a new one this year. I think it's a 28. Maybe it was the phase four or whatever, but I gotta save my pennies. It's kind of expensive, so you know.
Yeah, they're pricey. No,
But yeah.
the V3 is a good bow. So the last guy I had on, Dave Barnett, who works here at Go Hunt, I was talking to him about a bull he killed in the Wasatch, and I was asking him about his bow setup, and that's what he shot, was a V3.
Oh,
And
really?
yeah, similar reasons. And my V3, I ended up giving it to my brother in Wyoming, but that bow was short for me as far as axle. I think it was 32. I want to say the one that I had, which was normally I'm 6'2". I got a longer draw. So I typically like a longer axle to axle bow just based on the way that it aims and the stability in it. But that V3, that bow shot amazing for me. Like one of the best courses I've ever shot was I shot at TAC and I shot with Crispy and Colby Hanley from UltraView. And, you know, I was trying to keep up with those guys, but I think I came close to out shooting those guys that day. And But I was shooting a V3 that day. And I remember thinking, man, this bow is just, and I, you know, it was absolutely just hammering. So I get it. It's actually interesting that you say that. There's like, as I'm talking to you, there's like all these different things that you've made some trade-offs, right? So like we talk about shoes and stocking, right? Socks versus a hard-soled shoe and the reason that you do what you do. Same with a bow. You know, I was up shooting this morning and there's one target where there's kind of an overhanging limb. And I know that inevitably, if I stand underneath that limb, which is kind of where you got to stand to hit the target, my top cam, my limbs kind of brush that limb, right? And it's always annoying to me. I'm always aware of it, but there's a lot of times that, you know, is a possibility when you're hunting and it's a hunting situation. Now shooting a shorter bow for me would be a sacrifice because I don't know, that it would maybe hold or aim as well. It might not be as stable as a longer axle to axle bow, but maybe it's a trade-off that's worth making in a hunting situation. So I think, it's interesting that you, as I'm talking to you, and it's no surprise to me, but it feels like you are very detail oriented in the fact that you are evaluating these things down to a very macro scale to tip the scales in your favor.
Yeah, no, 100%. And that's why, once again, if I tried to explain it to somebody, mm-hmm. you know, it's not going to be the same for you as it would be for me. Right. And so I could share all of my tactics, but they're not going to be applicable for someone that's 6'2 and shoots a 32 inch draw length or whatever. Right.
Applicable, but they're worth thinking about, I think.
Yeah. Well, totally. Yeah. But like, you know, and that also goes back into like the arrow setup. Right. So if you've got mm-hmm. more speed than I do, you're going to have a lot more, I guess, flexibility in your arrows. You know, you could shoot a heavier arrow. Just there's so many variables there, like even your broadheads at that point. You can change, you could probably shoot fixed broadheads way better than my short axle to axle bow. If you chose, you know, I shoot mechanicals, I just shoot the Grim Reaper. I think it's an inch and 3/8 or something, three blade. The razor mm-hmm. tip, and I've had great luck with it, but yeah, it may not work for everybody. So it's hard to like encompass everything into like, this is how we should do it. Right. It doesn't work that way. It's an equation that everybody needs to figure out their own solution.
Yeah, I agree. There's not, you can't put everybody in a box as to what will work best, but I think it's really fun to talk to people that are doing it at a high level like yourself. You know, you've killed some phenomenal bucks and obviously dedicated to it. I've watched the videos and I'm like, man, this guy, I got to admit, man, at the shot, like you'll execute a shot, you know, you'll hit a buck and you seem so calm. I'm like, man, this guy is like so calm under pressure, it seems like. But I think it's, you can't really put everybody into a box as far as equipment choices and things like that. But I do think that these details are worth considering and then kind of working them through your own head, your own style, what it is that you need, what matters most, what's going to work for you, and then making your choices. But it's always fun to hear, you know, different perspectives and why people do and choose what they choose. So I think,
and you know, awesome. Talking about the shot, inside of me, I'm exploding with excitement, right, after a shot. But the thing that I learned on a specific buck in Idaho, it's actually a buck from last year. I didn't keep my cool, and mm-hmm. I did the shout, you know, and the bow raise, and like I was mm-hmm. all excited. And that buck, I thought he was dead, and he stood up and took off. And so what I learned was, is keep my cool after the shot and give it enough time for him to, like, if he's going to die within, 100 yards, I don't want him to hear me and run off further, So, yeah, so it's another lesson, that was learned is, I am very excited. I would do cartwheels and backflips for sure, but I kind of like, I don't want that buck to run off,
Yeah.
So
how much time are you spending scouting in the summers?
It depends on where I'm at. Okay. If I'm hunting resident deer, then it can begin whenever. Right. But like this Wyoming range stuff is different because they're traveling through, and usually mid July is when they're going to be where they're going to be. Mm-hmm. So up until that point, I'll go out and look. I'll see kind of what the buck antler growth is looking like, but I'm not going to pick a specific area up until maybe even August, just because they're not going to be into that spot. They're going to stay throughout the hunt until then. But if it's a resident deer, I do a lot of scouting, but not, I have the opinion that there's a lot of things that are going to happen between scouting and the hunt. Mm-hmm. And so I make sure, like, for example, up here we get sheep through these basins, right?
Yep.
And it doesn't matter if you scout that deer and he's there for 2 weeks in a row. As soon as those sheep come in, they are gone. Mm-hmm. They don't like sheep. And usually the sheep are coming through about the time right before the hunt. So if I know those kind of things, I won't scout those areas at all. Just because they're not going to be there. Or if I do scout and I find a target buck, I will look in adjacent canyons or adjacent draws, rather than in the location that I found them. Yep. But yeah, I don't spend a ton of time because I want to keep the days for hunting, mm-hmm. I can only take so many days off during the year. And yeah. So, yeah, I would say, yeah.
That's a good tip. Man, you've got hot takes today. I think people in the back of their head, they know that, that sheep will move deer out of a basin or an area. I think if you've seen a deer in an area, you fall in love with it and you're like, I'm going to go back, I'm going to find that deer. And you keep trying to force a square peg through a round hole. Right.
Yeah.
Even though
in the
back of your head, hey, this probably isn't conducive to being able to find this buck or this area holding deer this time of year. But you fall in love with like, oh, I did see him there here. I did see him. If I just stay with it. So I think that's a really good tip in that knowing when things like sheep moving into an area are going to impact it, knowing when they move out and then knowing what to do based on the fact that if they're in there, the deer are not going to be in there.
Yeah. So the same thing on, weather, depends on how quick the plants dry out. There's a lot of variables there for sure. But, I don't scout as much as I would like to. Usually when I find a target buck or a couple of them, I just stick with them and then just know that things are going to change. They may be a couple canyons over or whatever, but
yeah.
Talking about this, it gets me all excited, man. We got a whole nother year.
I know. I know. Yeah. I mean, one of our recent podcasts that we did, we got back from a Wyoming elk hunt the end of September and man, I slide into a depression. It's so hard for me to keep my chin up when it feels like September is over, boy, it's tough.
Yes.
Yeah. I was laying in bed last night thinking about it, man, another 11 months before I get a chance to get out and chase something, bugle and bull with my bow. Boy, it's hard to
handle. Yeah, I do have some rifle hunts coming up, so I've got my bow hanging in my room just on a hook, and every time I go in there, I feel like I'm, if I grab my rifle out of the safe or something, I feel like I'm cheating on my bow, I just, I just, look up at it and like, just because I don't have a choice, you know. I gotta use the rifle. But
sounds like you need to get into whitetail hunting. Go back to the Midwest. I know that for me, I've got a late season archery elk tag in Arizona, so I've got that to look forward to in November. But I know over the last few years, once I get back past September, I'm starting to think about, like, how can I extend my season with a bow? And I know that whitetail hunting is becoming increasingly more interesting to me, and it's something I want to try to figure out, you know, maybe get a week or two in a tree stand in November.
That sounds like a lot of fun, actually. I'd like to branch out more. I just get so focused on the mule deer because I love them so much, and every once in a while there's a bull in there, you know, a bull elk, but sure enjoy it. I need to go hunt some whitetails.
Yeah. Can I ask you about the Wyoming range, the Western Wyoming? You don't have to give up any intel that you don't want to, surely, but I know that people are always curious about, you know, G&H and how it's recovering based on that winter kill of 22-23. I myself am sitting on a pile of points. I think I've got, I want to say 13 or 14 deer points in Wyoming that, you know, for years I've been kicking around the idea of, like, what do I want to do with them? I'm curious as to, like, what your take is on that Western range in Wyoming as far as deer numbers, quality.
Yeah. Well, I hesitate to share too much, but sure. I do, but, I mean, I will, I don't have a problem because there's only a certain amount of tags, right? There's only a certain amount of non-resident tags. It's not like it's going to jump. The residents, it depends on how many residents there are, but I definitely don't have a problem sharing information based on, you know, the resident tags are what they are, or the non-resident tags, excuse me. So, but yeah, I would say, so this year has been, as far as antler growth, the variables that set this year up. So we had that bad winter, right?
Yep.
And we had, they almost went into shock. Like, the deer went into a shock situation for that next year. But then we had two mild winters in a row, right? Mm-hmm. And so they kind of, I think they almost that next year went into like a recovery process where their fat content was way higher. Mm-hmm. And then the year after that was the same situation. So all these fawns that we're getting at this point, the mothers are in extremely good shape. Right. So I would say, you know, and good mothers produce big deer. They produce big bucks.
Yep.
The genetics of the buck itself is important, but I think the mother plays a big role in how that deer, you know, grows up.
Yep.
So I would say, you know, the last couple of years we've had a really good fawn crop. The herd is, if you look at the numbers from, you know, Gary Fralick and those guys, it is increasing, but it's not like it was. And so if you come to Wyoming and you expect to see the 40 bucks you saw in the 90s or whatever it was in each basin, or it's not like that. But we do have all the variables that set up for this year. This was probably the best antler growth for a long, long time. Now I'm a recent resident. I've only been here for 4 years. So, and I've hunted it before, but I didn't get the glory years. I didn't get the 90s and earlier. So,
right.
But I would say in the future going forward, if you have a lot of points, there's kind of going to be a little bit of a gap because you've got these big deer that survived the winter and they're going to be really big, right? So they're going to have good antler growth. They're going to be in really good shape until the end of their life, which, you know, we probably killed a bunch of 4 to 6 year olds, I would say, this year. And so for the next couple years, it's going to be good. But then there's going to be a little bit of a gap. And then those fawns that were from those really healthy mothers are going to be growing up. And then you'll have another wave of them come in. So I don't know if that answers your question. I think the problem that for non-residents is going to be that the point creep's going to it's going to skyrocket because we killed some huge, huge deer in Wyoming this year. And I think everybody's seeing that. And because of that, everybody that's been holding points for 3 years is now going to probably drop them. Right. And so we're going to see G and H go from whatever they are, you know, 2 or 3 points, or I'd say probably 2 points higher. So that's my take on it. The deer herd is good. They're in good shape. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we get another mild winter and we get some more good fawn crop in the spring, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's good. I think you're, based on other people that I've talked to, I think you're spot on. It's not that there are a ton of deer. And I say a ton of deer is relative, right? I mean, for most people that I've talked to, there's not the numbers that there were prior to that winter kill, but the possibility for a great buck or a nice buck still exists if you're willing to hunt really hard and you've got some experience and you've got the days and the time to put into it. Everything you're saying makes complete sense. There's definitely going to be that, that age gap, that hole, right, from that winter kill. And then it's going to take a few years post beyond that to build back to bucks that are 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. And then I think once you get there, provided Mother Nature cooperates, you know, at that point, then you might be looking at, again, an issue, not necessarily of the herd, but just point creep. being able to actually draw the tag. The hard part that I have is it's like, I've got points. I want to burn them, you know? So it's like money in my pocket. Like I'm a little kid, like I got that money. I just want to burn it. So I've got those points and I'm like, oh, I want to go so bad, you know, when in reality it might be beneficial to wait a few years and maybe tip the scales even further in my favor. Once some of those bucks have been able to get some age class to them, you know, after that winter. So.
Yeah. And it's hard to say because you got, you know, when we stack all our hunts together, if we got Colorado and Idaho and, you got Arizona or whatever, you have to just kind of, you have to like look ahead and see what your year is going to look like. And if it's going to be, I think if you're going to come to Wyoming, just come to Wyoming, right? Make that the priority. That's kind of a hard thing to do, you know, because usually we'll draw some cool tags. So that's awesome.
Yeah. What got you into filming hunts? Why did you decide to do that and put so much time and effort? Cause it's not easy.
You know, I didn't do it for anything other than I wanted to show my boys. I've got in 2021 was my first film or my hunt. And, I told my kids, they were at that point 3 and 5. And I told them, they wanted to know what I was doing. And I said, well, I'll take my camera and I'll just, you know, it was just an iPhone, right?
All right. So unfortunately we lost part of the recording, part of that interview, the chat that I had with Matt, we ended up losing. There were just some issues at the end of the podcast and unfortunately we weren't able to recover that and I feel bad about it. I don't know exactly what happened. I'm not definitely savvy when it comes to recording equipment and using the podcast platform, trying to get better, obviously. But that's how you learn, right? You make a mistake or something happens and you try to learn how to avoid it in the future. So I apologize to you guys for not having the tail end of that. I did want to do kind of an ender. I didn't want to scrap the whole thing because there was a lot of good information that Matt offered. And again, I apologize to him and having that not work out. But the tail end of that podcast, we had about 15 more minutes where I talked to Matt about his filming. So I was curious in asking Matt about why the motivation to film a hunt. Because filming a hunt, especially by yourself, self-filming, I think earlier on the podcast, he said that it's nothing fancy. It's mostly raw and real. And I would agree with that, but Matt does a really good job at capturing, film on his hunts. And, you know, in talking to him, he basically said that he started doing it as a way to be able to share those experiences with his family. And you know, Matt's a humble guy. In talking to him, you could tell that he's a guy that genuinely loves hunting. He loves adventure. He loves the outdoors. He loves that entire process. And, you know, I got to commend Matt for putting in the time and the effort to film his hunts. He does a really good job. And I think it was really cool that he does that. And, you know, as somebody that just barely met Matt, I only came across his YouTube page maybe within the last couple of weeks. You know, I appreciated it. It was fun to watch. Once you get past hunting seasons and you're kind of moving into, you know, the winter months and then application season, I always like to go and try to find some of these hunts just to, you know, reinvigorate you, get you motivated, get you excited for the upcoming season. It's always fun to see other people's success. So we talked quite a bit about that. There were a couple of points in his most recent film that I watched that we talked about. So the hunt that I watched that kind of brought me to Matt was this 2025 Wyoming High Country father-son archery mule deer hunt. And Matt kills a great buck. He, you know, he kills 196 inch buck in Wyoming's High Country. Some of the most scenic, beautiful country out there in the lower 48. I would say it's really captivating and neat. I think anybody that's ever been interested in, you know, mule deer and then archery mule deer specifically, we all kind of dream of that high country spot and stock mule deer hunt for a giant buck. And, you know, Matt delivers on that film. So I would encourage you to go watch it. But what I really liked was a couple of pieces towards the tail end of the film. It was just that interaction between him and his dad. It was really fun to see he and his dad, you know, walk up to that buck, the conversation between them, you know, they're joking a little bit. And then, you know, they end up kind of getting it taken care of and packed out. And it was just fun to see that relationship between them. And, you know, I think that's why, or at least one of the reasons why a lot of us hunt is just the ability to get out with friends and family and, you know, build some memories and kind of reconnect in an environment that you're not bogged down by the day-to-day pressures. You know, you're not bogged down by your phone and, you know, emails and social media and all that kind of thing. So I thought that was really cool to see. The other part of his film that I really liked was there's a phone call that he records between he and his wife, and he calls his wife to tell him that he killed this buck. And I've had this experience, and, you know, hopefully many of you that are listening have as well. It's that effort that goes into a hunt like that. You know, maybe you found, especially if you found, you know, a big buck or a bull and that you've really been dreaming about it and planning and putting all your time and effort into it, and it means so much to you. It's so hard. And then, you know, when that does come together, those first phone calls to friends and family to just tell them that it worked out. And one of the things I really liked and appreciated was just the enthusiasm and the support that you could hear through her voice. It just bleeds out in that conversation. She's so excited for him. You know, they talk about him coming home and, you know, she wants to hear the whole story. And he says, yeah, you know, I'll give you the full story when I get home. Can't wait to share that with you. But then he says, yeah, we have another deer tag. My dad still has a deer tag. And she's so supportive in offering them the time to stay out in the field and to hunt together. And then, you know, hopefully fill a permit for his dad. And that was really cool. That was one of my very favorite parts of the film. So we talked a little bit about that as well. So I would encourage you, go watch Matt's films. It looks like he just released another one, a 2025 muzzleloader elk hunt in Idaho, I believe. And he goes out and takes a great 6-point bull. So anyway, just as a wrap up, I wanted to thank Matt. I apologize for not having the end of that conversation, you know, available for you guys to listen to. Yeah, go check out Matt. Go check out his film. If you need some motivation, you want to just watch some cool hunts, Matt's done a great job and a good dude. Genuinely a really good dude. I think at one point in this podcast, he says, you know, the hunting community is a good group of people. And I think that's true. I think it's a good group of people that really love it. You know, they're passionate about it. All the interactions that I had this year on that archery elk hunt that I had in Wyoming were good. Anybody that I would run into was so friendly, so upbeat, you know, talking to each other about what we were seeing, the experiences we were having, you know, trying to figure out what each other's plans were and give each other some space. You know, if you had an elk bugling and rutting and, you know, you talked to somebody and said, hey, this is the situation, people were more than willing to cut you a wide swath, kind of give you some space and try to help in your success and not impede you. you know, I've had some bad interactions, but I would say 99.9% have all been really good. And I think the hunting community is a good group of people. Certainly there's some bad apples out there, but I think for the most part, things have been really good and it's been a positive experience. And, you know, Matt talked about that a little bit as well towards the tail end there. So, just closer. Appreciate you guys listening. Sorry about the audio issues. Apologize to Matt for that issue. And, you know, good luck. There's still some rifle hunts coming out. I'm headed out tomorrow with my youngest boy. We're really excited. Hopefully we get a chance to get him his first deer. And if that's the case, I'm sure I'll jump back on the mic and maybe talk about it and give you some thoughts. But with that, it's going to be the podcast. I'll be back next week. Good luck to all you that still have permits in your pocket. Get out there and have some fun. Make some memories.